when I, you know, when you talk about, you know, the, that holding onto the land as if it's the culture because of the tradition on the land or the having been subsistent with the land, and in reading your book and my own experience, it seems like that it's so much more central or so much more, it's a tight community. Whereas when you have to leave, it's like you go to the city, you don't know your neighbors, you, and I don't know if, you know, is there, is that its own, I mean, that, I guess in a way, I think that that's, or that's what I understand by people saying losing their culture sometimes, having to go into this, like, just soup of people that don't necessarily have anything to do with one another, and there isn't that connectedness with community in the land. And I don't know if that's...
Well, I think when people migrate off of the land into the cities, and you had people who... I mean, this has been a trend for well over 100 years, and there have been different reasons for it at different times. Loss of land, dispossession, with the aftermath of Americanization was one phase of that, where people had to, they lost their land one way or another, and so that forced them into wage labor, forced them into migrations. Sometimes it was a circular migration for people who still had their land. They'd leave the villages and migrate out and come back. And that's been written about, people leaving seasonally, and eventually it became more permanent. Another big change took place after World War II, when there was such upheaval in the world and people left for the services and came back and could no longer make a living farming. So, and these were larger economic changes that was partly the loss of the land base or a good part of it, but was also a larger changing national and international economy that made people have to leave their communities in order to make a better living. And for a while, they had it to come back to, and then sometimes they had to sell the land. And I think that's a situation now where you have increasing urbanization and people starting maybe in the 1960s, when there was a real change in the real estate market in New Mexico, people, the land sold pretty cheap, and it always pretty much sold with the, if it was irrigated land, with the water rights, and then people came in and began buying it cheap and selling it dear, and so the prices escalated, and it became increasingly difficult for people to hold on to the one thing they had, which was their land and water, because the cost of living was going up. There weren't good ways in many of these communities to make living, even at wage labor, because if you're talking about northern New Mexico, the main economy is really government and tourism. And tourism doesn't necessarily give service workers a good living. It's a seasonal one. It often doesn't carry benefits. So in an economic crisis, people would have to sell their land in order to send their kid to college or to deal with medical catastrophes. I think increasingly as people begin to sell their land and then realize that it was being sold and resold at ever higher prices, and then they didn't even have that, there became more resistance to it. And I think people are now more skeptical and more resistant to selling their land and water than they were 25 years ago. But the movement to cities has always, from at rural agricultural areas, and it's not just New Mexico, this took place in Europe, it's taking place all over the world, involves an enormous change in lifestyle. People go from these communities where there's, where kinship is still one of the main ways that people are connected. I mean, the kinship system is still, in the rural areas of New Mexico, very powerful. People are living on land next to their relatives, land that they've inherited. They're on the acequia system. They go to the same, they belong to the same parish. They go to the same church, the same mission chapels. They're connected through generations. And then they pick up and move to Albuquerque or Denver or to Los Angeles. And they leave behind some people, but they leave behind this dense network of connection and of interdependence and of relationship that has gone on for generations, and they move into cities. And this is a classical transition for people. Suddenly, you go from this small face-to-face community to a large anonymous city where you don't know anybody, and you could die in your apartment and nobody would notice. Or you're living perhaps either in a city or ultimately in a suburb, and people are just connected very differently. So I think there's a sense, people talk about, well, we've lost our culture because we've lost our life ways, we've lost our connections, we're losing our language, we don't do what our grandparents did. And there's a sense that they've lost their heritage. Now, what I would say, yes, in a sense, they've lost their culture, but it's not like they don't have one. I mean, it's like you don't have... I would like to say that sometimes people believe that the only people who have culture are like, you know, people who are identified as ethnic and tend to be on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, and that Anglos or white people or urban people don't have culture. And no anthropologist would agree with that. If you're human, you have culture. But your traditions, your language, your ways of doing things in a rural community may be lost or changed. I think that's what people mean when they say they've lost their culture. And of course, language loss is a major phenomenon that's taking place with Native Americans as well as with later generations of Mexican Americans, certainly northern New Mexicans. There's been documented language loss, a kind of, in a way, a kind of cultural homogenization takes place. And I think globalization is furthering that, where people are speaking English, they're participating in a kind of national or even international media, urban kind of media-driven society, then they're no longer tied to the ancestral places and the ancestral practices. That's what people mean when they say they're losing culture. So moving from a small community to a huge city, you're losing a sense of interconnection. And and all the forms of reciprocity and exchange that people have had, the kind of collective rituals that they engaged in, fall away. And they may or may not be replaced by other forms of connection. One of the things that made me start doing research in New Mexico, where I grew up in Taos, was that it seemed to me that by the time I was in my 30s, that what we call Anglos, what we call Indians, and what we call Spanish Americans or Hispanos, culturally were more similar than they ever had been before, in the sense that both more people spoke English, they watched TV, they went to school together, they didn't dress so distinctively, that there was more shared culturally. But it seemed to me at the same time there was a kind of paradox, and I'm talking about from the 1960s on, that even though people had greater cultural similarity, their sense of difference and their sense of ethnic distinctiveness was becoming more intense. And that was one of the things that made me want to try to understand what was going on. Because a generation or so ago, anthropologists as well as other people and the whole kind of ethos of the United States was the melting pot. This notion that people who were culturally different, and often these were, you know, colonized or incorporated peoples who were considered racial minorities, there was this assumption that eventually they would melt into mainstream American society and that we would all be sort of culturally homogenous. But what happened in the 60s and the 70s was that these civil rights movements and these ethno-political movements arose, and people began proclaiming their difference and their distinctiveness. And so there was no longer the sense that you had to assimilate, but that you wanted to hold on to who you were and to your culture and your traditions and your language. And so there was a kind of nationalism that developed among Native American groups and certainly among Mexican Americans, Chicanos. Obviously, African Americans and the civil rights movement was a key development and a catalyst in some ways for some of these other developments. So you had these movements, and you had people like in my generation who, I mean, I grew up in a small town that was still in many ways traditional. Spanish was predominant, although I grew up speaking English. The Catholic Church was predominant. I grew up in a kind of community that I think a lot of the people I later went to school with and that I work with did not. Moving to a city was a big shock for me. But somehow, let me put it this way, I became a New Mexican when I moved to New York. I didn't think about what I was before then. I just, you know, I didn't think about being a Mexican American until somebody said, oh, you're a Mexican American, aren't you? In a way, that's what I'm talking about, is sort of, even the globalization is creating homogenization, but at the same time, all over the world, it's also sort of, people are resisting it. And so you have local revivals and recreations, reinventions of tradition, the revitalization of ritual practices, a kind of proclamation of local identities as they're being threatened and as they're being absorbed by these global processes. And when I say that land has become a symbol in a way that it wasn't 100 years ago, that's what I mean. So something is it's constantly changing. And so you may have people whose parents wanted them to speak English because they wanted them to have opportunities, going back and learning Spanish, going to Mexico to learn Spanish. This is happening in Hawaii with Native Hawaiians. It's happening all over. So it's a kind of self-consciousness about culture and about identity and about ethnicity that is a function of having it threatened.
Thank you. Could you talk about the in-migration phenomena? I know you kind of touched a little bit on it.
Right. Well, there have been big demographic changes. And again, I mean, this is happening in New Mexico, but it's not unique to New Mexico. Rural New Mexico has been exporting its youth and its labor for generations. And this is since at least the late 19th century. And for a long time, up until, I think, well, certainly the 1930s, and then again during World War II and after World War II, the rural communities of New Mexico, people were leaving them in order to work first seasonally and then permanently. And so there was, if you look at the census figures for those years, there was a population loss. I'm most familiar with the county of Taos, and it's interesting that during the 1930s, once people began to sort of make distinctions between ethnic groups in the census, it was clear that some people were migrating out and some people were moving in. If I'm not wrong, I think during the 1930s, the 20s, there was population loss. There was population loss in the 40s. There was population loss in the 50s. In the 30s, there was some regaining of population as some people came back during the Depression to get back on the land to farm. What began to happen in the 1960s was that even though there had been a steady trickle of Easterners, people from the Midwest who had moved into places like Taos and Santa Fe, where you had art colonies and which were becoming centers for tourism development, tourist attractions, people who would come as tourists and be enchanted by the place and decide that they wanted to move there, sometimes initially just for the summer. And this is how the art colonists got started in places like Taos and Santa Fe. They were trying to escape the anonymity, the disillusionment, in some cases people thought that the loss of community, the loss of innocence, to get away from the polluted cities where there was crime and corruption and all of the evils of urban life. And they came to places like Taos and Santa Fe to escape that, and they saw this wonderful, rustic, primitive landscape that they and peoples, Native Americans and Mexican Americans, that they projected onto. And so there was this sense that they were coming here to recover something that they themselves had lost, or that their ancestors had lost by moving to the city. So there was this romantic notion of what New Mexico was. And so you had middle-class, urban, white people, what we call Anglos here in New Mexico, moving back, buying houses, and making a living here. And often their source of income was external to New Mexico. So that's been a trend here for a long time. But I don't think it was until around the 1960s, and then increasingly in the decades that came after, that more and more people began to move. Certainly the great hippie invasion of the 1960s would be one example, where you had these upheavals that were happening not only in this country, but also, for example, in France. And this was tied to, you know, these things that were happening that I don't know if we even fully understand what caused all of those upheavals of the 1960s, of which the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War and the protests against it and the psychedelic movement were all part of that, and the ethno-political mobilizations, not just the Black Power movement, but the Native American movement, the Chicano movement, then later the women's movement. All of these were part of what was going on. But the demographic change increasingly has been, I call them amenity migrants, not a term I invented, but that's used. These are people who come first as tourists and then decide to move here, not to get a job, because mostly people leave New Mexico to get a job, but to come back and to enjoy the amenities that brought them here first as tourists. And they generally have a higher level of education and income than the native people. And they also often invested in the tourism industry and became developers of the tourism industry, also of real estate and of the construction industry. So they became sort of the new business owners of a lot of the services and the businesses that are connected to the tourism industry. So they could buy cheap and sell dear. And at the same time, you had people moving out for a living and selling their patrimony to get a foothold. So the whole process of gentrification, which is the replacement of a poorer population by a wealthier one, and a corresponding transformation of the architectural environment, people buying old broken down adobes and turning them into, you know, renovating them. Used to be, when I grew up, people would say that only the very rich or the very poor lived in adobe. Now the poor and even the lower middle class live in trailers, and only the rich live in adobes, unless you happen to have been able to hold on to your patrimony. That is, your family had adobe houses and had land, and people are holding on to that. But there are all these forces that sort of conspire against people holding on to their land, their adobe houses, and their water rights. Another really important demographic change that is taking place in New Mexico, and not just New Mexico, that doesn't get much recognition, and it hasn't been written about by scholars, is the movement of Mexican nationals. There's been this myth that somehow the Spanish Americans of New Mexico were pure Spanish, and almost as if, you know, they came here without having passed through Mexico, and that these villages were enclaves of Castilian culture. And that's a myth that was promoted largely by the tourism industry. And there are racial politics connected to that, because I think that also involves a certain claim to whiteness. But one thing that's been the case for generations is that, I mean, the border came in after the Mexican-American War. Before that, this was Mexico. And people were moving back and forth. And they continued to move back and forth after the Mexican-American War. And they continue to move back and forth today. I think if you talk to families who've been in New Mexico for generations, I'm talking about Nuevo Mexicanos, you will find if you talk to them about who's in their family, there will always be someone from Mexico. And there will usually be, you know, obviously Native Americans, whether they're Apaches or Navajo or Pueblo or Comanche peoples who are part of their family tree that may or may not have been acknowledged, as well as what we call Anglos. But the movement of Mexican nationals into New Mexico is increasing. There's no question about it. Used to be people would know in a small community who the Mexican nationals were, and there were certain kinds of... I mean, there's always been a Chihuahua, northern New Mexico axis, a pathway of migration. And I think it's moved both ways. But now there are people moving into the United States, every state in the Union. People are coming from Mexico and from other parts of Latin America, Central America. They're changing... They are changing the demographics. They're changing the streetscapes. There are more and more businesses that cater to Mexicans, that are owned by Mexicans, not simply coming as itinerant workers, obviously as migrant workers and as farm workers and as construction workers, as service workers. But also, I think there are middle-class businesses developing, and I think they're largely uncounted. And when people talk about the mix in New Mexico, they sometimes leave that out. And it's a really interesting and important part of what's going on here. So that's also adds to the complexity of Latino populations or Mexican-American populations. They're not homogeneous. None of the populations under the big three, the big tri-ethnic myth of New Mexico, are monolithic. There are all kinds of complexity and mixes within them, and that's increasing, I think.